Hey there, my name is Oisin Lunny and this is Audio Matters, a weekly podcast on all things audio presented to you by Harman. This week's episode is all about car audio, how it works, why it's important and what's under the hood of the best car audio systems on the planet. So pull up to the bumper, hit the autobahn and we'll have fun until Daddy takes the T-Bird away with our trio of experts who are Greg Sikora, the Director and Head of Acoustic Systems Engineering in Europe for Car Audio at Harman International. Stefan Varga, the Senior System Acoustic Engineer for Car Audio at Harman International. And Dr. Amy Belfi, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychological Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Welcome all to the podcast. So at the time of recording, the world is gradually easing its way out of lockdown in many countries. And this means two things. One, my hair looks like Dr. Emmett Doc Brown from Back to the Future. We literally could be twins. And two, many people are rediscovering the sheer joy of driving while listening to great music and reconnecting with the soundtrack to the different parts of their day. But what makes a truly great in-car audio experience? Let's start at the beginning. Amy, your research focuses on the behavioral and the neural mechanisms underlying aesthetic experience, and most specifically around music. And I know that you use things like behavioral studies, psychophysiology, and neuropsychological studies to understand this. So, I mean, no pressure, but can you explain why music is important to us and why do we like it so much?
Sure, I can try. That's a hard hard thing to explain, and a lot of people are working on trying to come up with pieces of the answer to that question. Sure. So yeah, some of my work is focused on, I like to tell people that I want to get at the question of why do we like what we like, which is essentially the question you just posed, and it's a big one. The first thing to note that we've all probably experienced is that people like different things, and that sounds obvious to us, but some of my work and the work of others has provided, you know, empirical data to support that assertion that people have different tastes. And the question of why are people's tastes different is, it incorporates a lot of elements. It's, you know, some things that are that happen during development. As you're growing up, you establish tastes at a certain point in your life, typically around adolescence. And those, my work specifically focuses on how kind of those songs that you listen to at certain points in your life become associated with vivid memories of those times. So oftentimes we like music because it reminds us of particularly vivid or happy or emotional moments from our life. So that association between music and kind of happy or joyful memories or vivid memories is one potential reason why we might like music. So of course you can like a piece of music that you've never heard before in your entire life. So that's not the only explanation, but a lot of my work really focuses on that aspect of music, that it really is a good trigger for those types of vivid memories that we like to re-experience.
Mm. And typically, you know, I mean, does it take you long to know if you like a piece of music or not, or how quickly does that actually happen?
Right. So I've done, I did a series of experiments trying to get at that question, which is how soon will you be able to tell whether or not you like a piece of music? So what we did in these experiments, we had people listen to really, really, really short snippets of music. And we asked them, okay, how much did you like that? It's, you know, a little blip. And then they got progressively longer and longer. And when they listened to a long version, what we'd do is we'd see at what point in those short clips did their rating or their assessment of how much they like it match up with what they rated it when they heard, you know, a longer version of the piece. So the question is, if you only hear 1 second of a piece, does that actually match your assessment of the entire piece of music? And what we found was perhaps surprising, but people were generally able to accurately assess how much they liked the piece within less than a second. So that's extremely fast. And I like to relate it to when you're driving in the car and you're kind of flipping through the radio stations. You could do that pretty fast. And it turns out that those judgments that you make, those snap judgments, are actually quite accurate in terms of how you would rate the entire piece.
Now, Greg, you're responsible for the sound experience of Harman Kardon, Bang & Olufsen, Bowers & Wilkins and JBL Automotive Systems in Europe. And these are deployed by numerous OEMs or original equipment manufacturers. We've just heard there from Amy about the kind of mechanisms that decide whether you like a piece of music, how quickly you like a piece of music, and, you know, why it's such a central part of our identity as humans. So what are the physical, perceptual and psychoacoustic considerations that connect this art of music that's so central to us with the art of listening? Take us, if you will, on the next stage of that journey.
That's a complex question. I mean, what we do in acoustic systems engineering is basically fusing two worlds, the world of music, the world of art, and the world of engineering. I mean, you cannot really separate the two. I mean, I like to think about our job. I mean, we are at the service of music. I mean, the music is created by the artists. And our job is to translate the message of the artist, the intention of the artist, the emotions in that music into different environments. I mean, for car audio, we need to bring it into the car. But that is also true for engineers designing speakers for your room or designing a sound at large venues. Then when we go into this design process, obviously we have constraints that are related to the car itself, to the specific components. We have recipes for each brands. Well, we call it requirements, but I think the word recipe is just, I like it more. But based on that, I mean, all the choices we make in designing the system is always we need to filter that through how much benefit does it bring to music reproduction. I mean, engineering is an art of the compromise, and our job is to make the least amount of compromises to create a great system.
You spoke about the recipes for each brand. I guess that's the ingredients, the engineering ingredients to make this wonderful alchemy between engineering and art. Mm-hmm. Just moving on to you, Stefan, you hold a lot of patents and pending patents in the field of sound reproduction in vehicles. And you've actually designed surround and 3D upmixing algorithms for the automotive industry, for OEMs such as Ford, I believe, in close collaboration with B&O. So taking into account what Amy and Greg have just been talking about, tell us a bit about how to go about designing that last mile, or indeed that last kilometer of the audio journey. How do you bring it all together actually in the cabin of your favorite automobile?
The last kilometer is actually a long kilometer, I would say, because there are several things that need to be in place to have a great sound system in the end. And in the end, I really want to, you know, pick up on what Amy just said. Everybody has a different taste in music, and I guess really my job is to make it possible for everyone to listen to all styles of music there are in the world. And we use thousands of music pieces to test the sound systems in the car and really make sure that all the styles sound great without, you know, having to do any adjustments or something like that. So there are some challenges that we have, and I would say these challenges are, first of all, when you set the design strategy, like Greg mentioned, one of the challenges is obviously, you know, bringing speakers into the car. How many speakers, for how many speakers do we have room in the car? How big can they be? Where can we place them? We need to find a good orientation for the speakers. We really want to, you know, put in speakers that cover the whole frequency range, right? From the sub bass frequencies all the way up to the highest frequencies that we can hear. That's about 20 kilohertz. Not in my age anymore, probably, but it's very age dependent. It is, and then we have a certain process that we follow. Like we have an objective process and a subjective process where we use tools like microphones and a measurement system to make sure that the speaker works optimally. But also the subjective part where we then sit in the car and spend a lot of time tuning the system with different ingredients, like Greg mentioned, that we use for our recipe, with different tools that we use to make the sound even better and more natural. And you will always need human ears to make this little, you know, this last adjustment, the subjective adjustment to, you know, make a voice sound natural, make this music piece that you know very well sound as it should sound. We use a reference room for that. So I constantly switch between a reference room where I have the perfect sound, the perfect room, I can transport that into the car.
Wild. As you say, it's quite a complex recipe there. And you guys truly are the master chefs. I'm pretty impressed here. We're going to come back to that. Amy, we've heard about the human aspect of listening, why it's primal, why it's important. And then we've heard some of the artistic engineering that goes into having a great listening experience in a car. But this comes down very much to human emotions. Music is all about human emotions, and they're so important. And I believe that Ford came to you and asked you to investigate why sound in the car is so important. Could you tell us a bit about that study and that work and what you found out?
Sure. So yeah, I did a study with Ford and Spotify a couple years ago, and we were specifically looking at how different types of music that you listen to during your commute can influence your emotions and feelings both during the drive and after the drive. So what we did in that study was we had participants, before they got in the car for their commute, they rated their current emotional state using a questionnaire. And then we gave them a single playlist to listen to during their drive, and different participants got different playlists. And the playlist systematically varied on two emotional variables. So the two variables from the psychology perspective are called valence and arousal. But in kind of general terms, valence just means the kind of emotional quality of the music, whether it's positive or negative. So positive valence could be happy, but it could also be peaceful. And negative valence could be sad, but it could also be angry. And then the arousal level is a kind of a term for the energy of the piece. So a piece with high arousal would be very high energy, or, you know, faster tempo, whereas a piece with low arousal would be lower energy or a slower tempo. So people listened to playlists that either had, you know, high valence, high arousal pieces, high valence, low arousal pieces, etc. And so we had them rate their emotions before they got in the car. They got in their car, did their normal commute, listened to the playlist, then they rated their emotions after they got out of the car, and then for a couple hours throughout their day. So what we found was that it turns out that the valence of the playlist didn't really have a strong effect on mood, but that it was more the arousal level. So the playlists that had the pieces with higher arousal or higher energy were associated with an increase in positive emotions after the drive. So it wasn't really that, you know, the happy or sad sounding pieces influenced the mood or were associated with a change in mood, but it was more that the higher energy pieces were associated with a positive boost to the mood. So that was kind of the interesting takeaway, that it was the arousal of the music that really influenced people's emotions.
That's super interesting. My goodness. Yeah. And I mean, it's something that all of us music lovers know instinctively, but it's incredible to hear about some of the science behind, you know, why, you know, we get the hairs on the back of our neck stand up when we hear a certain piece of music. So coming over to yourself, Greg, I'd be really interested to know, because you have a phenomenal CV. I mean, you've got experience in systems design, sound recording, reproduction, audio design, music performance, acoustics, psychoacoustics, multimedia, broadcasting. You have a master's degree in audio engineering and a master's degree in sound recording. Is this the perfect job for you? The short answer there. It's pretty incredible.
No, I just wanted to extend my time at a new university. That's all, you know. No, it's just, you know, coming from. I mean, there's audio or sound. It has so many faces and so many aspects. I was just curious to learn about, you know, what is how we can describe the sound from audio acoustics point of view, so physics point of view. But it's also fascinating how actually your brain So more kind of first your hardware responds to sound, so your ears, your auditory nerves, and then the next level is actually how your brain reacts to sounds, and then later to something complex, so complex like music. And it's, I mean, it's difficult to separate the two, especially in the job that we are doing. I like to think about this duality of sound. I mean, on one aspect you have sound as an acoustics phenomenon, physical phenomenon. You know, I mean, sound is nothing else and just, you know, vibration that is traveling through the air. I mean, you hit something, you excite an object, an instrument, and then just travels through the air and hits your ear. And then you have lots of processes going from your outer ear to your inner ear, middle ear, and then to your inner ear, and then through the nerves to your brain. And this is already science on itself, what happens there. And that's then, once the sound hits your ear, then you are talking already about the sound as a perceptual phenomenon. It's, I mean, there is this philosophical dispute: if the tree falls in the forest, doesn't make a sound?
Yes.
Well, no. It does. It produces the acoustics waves. Yeah. You know, you can measure that. You can describe it, but the sound is only made when there is someone to perceive the sound. The sound happens when it hits your ears and then goes to your brain. Otherwise, if there is no one to experience an acoustics waves, there is no sound. So. So the whole science of that is basically psychoacoustics, and that's also an aspect of, I mean, the fundamentals of the psychoacoustic is something that we do every day, as Stefan mentioned, in the sound tuning process. We are basically using different kind of tools and tricks to fool our brain to create an illusion of sound. For example, you sit in the car and you feel that the singer is in front of you.
Yeah.
But there might be no speaker in front of you. So it's actually your brain creates that image based on the input. So that's psychoacoustics. That's this duality of sound. That simply fascinates me.
That's incredible. I didn't expect to get an answer to the question about if a tree falls in the woods. I think I'll ask you next, why did the chicken cross the road? I've been wondering about this for decades. that's really fascinating. Thank you. We're on such an interesting thread here, which is really the overlap between psychology, anatomy, how the mind works, how humans respond to music, and the incredibly detailed, fine engineering that goes into the systems that you design. Talk to us a bit about how your engineering expertise is bought into the, you know, the quote unquote room of a car, and what kind of experiences you can have in maybe in a car that you can't have in other spaces.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, first of all, every car is different, and every car, you know, has its own room characteristics, And I see myself as someone who designs an audio system in a small cabin, basically, with a lot of speakers. And I would say this is one of the big challenges, as if you would design a speaker system with, let's say, two speakers. These could be in any room, right? So there are different challenges there. So if you just design a pair of speakers, you don't know in what room they will be, you know, be used. But in a car, you have, you know, all kinds of reflections from windows. You have the seats, the cloth seats, that, you know, take some sound away. You have a cabin, with seats that are not positioned, in a so-called sweet spot, which just defines, you know, the ideal listening position in a room between two speakers. And in a car, you deal with a lot of speakers. You don't just deal with four speakers, let's say two tweeters and two woofers in the front. You deal with a lot of speakers, and you kind of have to organize yourself in the beginning. You have to set every speaker to the right sound. You have to work with every single speaker first, and make the speakers work together and not work against each other, and kind of create a sound field in the car. And then there are systems that have speakers, you know, in the doors and in the IP, and there are also systems that have speakers in the roof, even to open up in a third dimension, like to kind of have a height feeling, a more natural playback feeling. So this is kind of one of the steps in the engineering work, to organize yourself with all the speakers that you have and make them sound great, and then use tools to influence your psychoacoustics in the car, your what you perceive. What Greg just said with the voice, you might hear a voice in front of you, although there's no speaker there. It's like if you wear a pair of headphones and you listen to music, where do you hear the singer? You don't, like when this, like the main singer normally, you hear from both headphones. So the singer is somewhere in your head above you. It has a spot that you cannot really define. Same as if you sit in front of a pair of speakers and you have an optimal position in a you know, more or less good room, you will have a phantom image in front of you, although there is no speaker there. So we use tools like time and EQs to influence the sound in a way that that we can enjoy the music in the end.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Amy, talk to us a bit about the impact that sound has on your driving experience. Because again, I'm wondering, could you reference some of that brilliant research that you did, which is about how music can affect your mood, not only on the journey itself, but, you know, does the effect of music carry on into your day? And how does that work?
Right. So first of all, I just want to say you guys are making me feel like I should go back to school and get more degrees. I'm like, this is such cool stuff. You guys, it's so cool. It's so interesting. I'm learning a lot. But yes, yeah, so but as part of that study, we were interested in seeing not only how the music affects us while we're driving, but do those effects kind of carry on through the rest of the day? So we did find that not only were people's moods elevated after the drive, particularly those people who listened to the playlist that had the high arousing music or the high energy music, but that some people, even throughout the next 2 hours, reported elevated moods above where they were before they got in the car. And I got the idea for this experiment from a study that I'm working on with a couple colleagues of mine who are clinicians, clinical psychologists, and a music therapist. And we were interested in doing a really strong test of this. And it doesn't have to do with driving, but I think it's related to the idea of how long does music have its effect on our mood. And so what we did was we wanted to study this in patients who have Alzheimer's disease. And we wanted to see, do these individuals who have very, you know, serious memory deficits, do they still show increased mood after listening to music, even if they don't remember that they heard the music at all? So this is a really fun and cool study to do. But what we found was that even individuals who, so we had them come into the lab and they listened to music that would likely evoke happiness or sadness. And as you might expect, right after they heard the very happy music, they felt happier. But what we found was that even, you know, 20 minutes after hearing the music, they still felt happier. But when we asked them what they heard, they didn't remember. So I think this is a really strong, strong evidence for the idea that music has prolonged effects on our mood. And those effects don't even rely on our memory for the music. It's this kind of implicit feelings that we get from music that can outlast even our explicit knowledge that we heard music at all. So I think there's some good evidence that music has very profound and strong effects on our emotions and feelings.
Yeah, that's wild. That's so interesting. And Greg, I'm just wondering, you know, coming back to that the MasterChef analogy that I absolutely love. You know, I believe this is something that you do. You're talking about bringing this great emotional experience to the fore in these, you know, beautiful cars with great sound systems. How do you go about matching the personality of the automotive brand with the personality of the audio equipment and brands that you're working with? I mean, do you do some matchmaking and some pairing the certain types of audio equipment with certain types of car brands, etc.? How does that all work?
There is a certain target group for cars. The description of a typical buyer, or even it can be one brand, one OEM brand, but also different car types. And we have the same for our brands. So the first analysis it happens in that let's say marketing domain.
Yeah.
Once this analysis is done and we see a match between a specific OEM and the brand, then we cross check the requirements for each brand, and each brand, as I mentioned, has a recipe, but it's not only a recipe from the not only on the subjective level how it should sound. It's actually it goes more fundamental. We have recipes for system design. So what should be a speaker arrangement? What kind of speakers? For some brands, we even specify the material of speakers or specific acoustic technologies. Either hardware technologies, but also DSP, digital signal processing technologies. Mm. So it's a kind of a whole recipe for the system. And together with tuning, it defines the final outcome. I mean, continuing this master chef analogy, speakers, the amplifier are like the main ingredients. Uh-huh. So if you're, let's say, cooking a specific dish, then maybe you want to use the meat of a, you know, from a specific region of the country.
Yes.
For example, or you use vegetables from, you know, a specific origin or specific type. So this is, we have the selection of the components. Then we have all that the DSP features. It's like our spices. So this is also, I'm referring to what Stefan did before. Then in the tuning process, so in the cooking process, you need to prepare all your ingredients before you put them together. So there is this preparation period or the process. And then the tuning, the actual tuning, you could compare it to the cooking process. How strong you want to have a bass in your car within the general accepted criteria. I mean, there is such thing as a good sound, a faithful reproduction, but there are still some margins that you can make the design choices. I like to think about the tuning process that you are designing the sound experience. And that goes for how you use your components. So it's actually quite a long process. We start working with some OEMs 4 to 5 years before the start of the production. It takes time. It takes an effort from a lot of people. Actually, not many people realize how many people you have to involve, how many engineers, how many project managers, and the people with different knowledge from different disciplines to bring a sound system into the car.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating journey, and at the end, what matters is the music.
Yes,
that's what at the end it's music that we want to convey the musical message to our listeners, the listeners of our car audio systems.
Yeah, it's a really unique space in which to talk about sound design. I think
it's challenging space.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a small space. I mean, what Stefan mentioned already, at least we know where people are.
Yeah,
but then you have all that noise. You're driving the car, so your system needs to fight with the noise. We have specific algorithm for that also have to be tuned, how the system compensates for the amount of noise, or with some technologies we can even cancel some of the road noise. So it's a hostile environment,
yeah,
to reproduce sound, but also offers a unique, very unique opportunities for us.
Yeah, that's so incredible. I mean, that 5-year life cycle is mind blowing. You know, the attention to detail.
If you think about the whole chain of the sound reproduction, you have the artist in the studio.
Yeah.
Let's take a simple example. You have a singer. So you start with the recording. So already by choosing the right microphone and the room that you're recording to already has an influence on the sound.
Mm.
Then it goes into your mixing desk, and in the control room in the sound recording studio, you listen on specific speakers, and these speakers have a certain sonic quality, a character. Your mixing board, the plugins or different peripherals you use when you're working on that sound. Then you go through the whole mixing process, the mastering process, then it goes into broadcasting on maybe it goes on Spotify or on the CD on some kind of medium. Then from that medium, it enters the amplifier of the car audio system. And then you have the influence of the room, influence of the speakers, the influence of the tuning of different algorithms. And then at the end, what you want to do is translate that musical message from that studio, from the moment it was recorded, to the passenger in the car. There is so much processing along the way, but yet still we can preserve it to the very high degree. This fascinates me, the whole journey between the artists, the artist and your ear.
Yes, yes. And
your brain, actually, I should say.
So this is fascinating. We all take car audio for granted, and to some extent, we all take music for granted. It's just always been part of our lives. But why do you think that we even have music?
Well, it's difficult to say. There are a couple of theories out there, but the fact is that music is a part of the human civilization, of human being. I mean, we have some evidence. Archaeologists found early instruments dated 40,000 years. So there is an evidence that we've been making music, and even in modern times, there are some societies, contemporary societies, that have been not influenced by the modern civilization. So basically, kind of being in isolation for many years, still at the hunter-gatherer stage. And they also make music. Basically, we haven't found a civilization or a tribe, group, or whatever without music. What is interesting is that the music and dance has been connected for so many years and separated only recently. I mean separated. I mean, we still have music and dance, but let's say last several hundreds of years, we also created this experience that you have a professional musicians and you have a concert hall and you go to the concert hall to listen to music. Before that, music and dance was inseparable and it was accessible for everyone. Part of the reason for that is actually the reptile part of our brain, the cerebellum. One of the functions of the cerebellum is actually keeping the pace. So, for example, when you run, you keep the pace. You know, kind of it's keeping the rhythm. Without that, we would have no idea how to walk with the fixed gate, so fixed space. And actually, music taps into that region as well. That's why we tap our foot. That's what when we hear a specific music, I mean, in the certain tempo, we want to move, and or we want to dance. And this whole connection also then translates into dopamine release, and then increases our mood. So music activates your whole brain. There's no such thing as a music area in your brain. The music experience takes your whole brain. That's why it's so fundamental to who we are at the end.
Amy, does this in part explain why I can listen to music quite loud driving down the motorway into Barcelona, but once I get into town and the traffic's a bit more tricky, I have to turn the volume down? Is that something to do with that whole brain ownership of music?
Well, I think it's especially related to the concept of attention and kind of the idea that we have limited cognitive resources that can be kind of deployed at a certain time. So when we listen to music, even if we consider it as like a background, you know, a lot of us have music on in the background when we're doing various tasks, including driving. And maybe you don't feel like you're paying very much active attention to it. But yeah, as you mentioned, I'm guessing most of us who drive have had the experience of driving into maybe a new place. You're looking for someone's house you've never been to, or a new city, or even, you know, a city you're familiar with, but it's particularly, there's an accident and there's a lot of traffic or something. And then in those moments, you turn down the volume to focus more. And so that's a kind of intuitive way that we're regulating these attentional or cognitive resources, so that when you need to use more of those resources to focus on a task at hand, such as driving in a new scenario, you can't dedicate any resources towards listening to music. So then you turn down the music. So when you eliminate that other distraction, in that case, music would be kind of a distractor from the task at hand, and turning it down is our way of kind of regulating the number of stimuli in our environment so that we can focus on the drive and exclude the other distractions like the music.
No, I'm just thinking that this is probably also related to the type of music. Mm. It's I can imagine that some, you know, very this ambient music might take it's basically designed for background listening, might take less of your attention than some upbeat rock and roll.
I've actually been really interested in this question and wanting to do some studies on it, but I haven't gotten to it yet, because I also suspect that it's your familiarity with the music too, right? Because we can learn, there's a lot of research on showing that you can learn to ignore distractors. So if you've had a lot of experience with a piece of music, my prediction is that you're more likely to be able to tune it out and focus than if it's a new or novel piece of music. Or, you know, alternatively, you know, if it's a piece of music that really carries a lot of emotional weight for you or is associated with personally significant memories, maybe that piece would be more distracting because you'd be thinking about all of the like good times you had while you listened to this song. So I suspect your point is correct, that it really depends on not only the qualities of the music you're listening to, but also all the other associations you have wrapped up in the music. So some types of music may be distracting for some people, but not for other people. You know, the whole takeaway is that like this stuff is hard to study because everyone is different in terms of what they like and how they, you know, respond to certain types of music.
A topic of what kind of music do we prefer? I mean, we call it a musical taste, but what it is, if you break it down, why do we like certain types of music or certain tunes? Why some songs become a hit song and some don't? It's really also interesting discussion on its own. What I learned is the music you like, it's a fine balance between familiarity. So the music has to be familiar to you. It cannot be, you have to have a context So you need to know something about the music, about a specific genre. But if it's too unfamiliar, then you won't like it because you don't really have a develop a scheme how to analyze the music. It's unpredictable. And we like, I mean, human beings overall, we like to predict things. It's actually very satisfying to predict something. So when you listen to music, you have a tempo, you actually are tapping your foot and you're predicting the rhythm. And that's it's a satisfying experience. But at the same time, if you can predict everything in the music piece, then it's boring. It basically gets boring. So the best songs are the songs that are fall into your familiarity, your education, your background, your knowledge about the specific music. But there has to be some kind of surprise element there. Something that maybe a broken rhythm or maybe a certain harmonic modulation that you didn't expect. Or maybe an artist use an instrument that you haven't heard before, or maybe it's a synthetic instrument that just, you know, developed, synthesized. And that makes a hit song. Either it's your personal hit song or it's a global hit song. For example, one interesting fact is we all know the Beatles song Yesterday. I mean, apart from the words, just analyzing the music, I recently read that it's actually the Beatles, this specific song has a 7 measures or 7 bars phrasing. Typically, we have 8 bars. It's divided in 4-4. You have this, you know, question, answer, and call, response. But it actually has 7 measures.
Wild.
So that makes it interesting because it's different than everything else. And every time you listen, it violates your expectation. You think it's, oh, this is, I'm going to have 1 more bar. No, then he starts with the second phrase, and that's your brain likes that. If it's too far away, we don't like it. If it's everything is predictable, it's boring. So it's that fine balance that musicians make to make music interesting.
It seems you have the right recipe for the next one-hit wonder, Greg.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Life moves fast, but sound moves faster. So maybe the secret to a good life is moving in the right direction with your favorite music. So thank you so much to Greg Sikora, Stefan Varga, and Dr. Amy Belfi for taking us under the hood of great car audio. Don't forget to subscribe to the Audio Matters podcast using your favorite podcast app and check out our brilliant Tidal playlist chosen each and every week by our special guests with a few from me as well. Join us next week when we go through the audio keyhole to have a look inside some pro cribs. See you next week.